There you go. Good to go. So, Beryl, you've got such an amazing story. My first time in church, you talked to me and I was in tears. So
I might end up in tears this
morning. Yeah, yeah. Can you start by sharing how do you come to faith?
Yes. In a nutshell,
yeah.
Through Alpha. But before that, as a small girl, I was not forced to go to church or Sunday school. I tried it. I hated it. I was bored stiff with it. As a teenager, I paid no attention whatsoever to God. I did the usual, liked Christmas, came to know about Mothering Sunday and did the usual then. But apart from that, and even when my grandparents died, if I'm absolutely honest, I was jolly glad when my grandma died because she used to nag me because I never did my piano practice properly. But bless her, I'm afraid that that was not a good thing to do.
Yeah, we all do that.
Yeah, we do. And you all do it, you know. And those of you that have got children, it'll come to you too. There comes a time when they push the old ones on one side, you know. No, seriously, there's a lot of family togetherness. Family is important, and the family of God is important too. So how did I come to faith? Well, my husband died after 4 years suffering with cancer, best part of 4 years. I was 58 years old. He was 62. And when he died, I was actually in a frozen place. I had no feelings whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I took myself off to Australia to see my sister as a break from looking after him. My children all looked after my home and animals, and they all moved in the family home while I was gone. And in fact, when I got there, my sister had booked me to go around Tasmania for a month, so I was away for 9 weeks altogether. I think my children thought I wasn't coming back, but I did come back. And I was really angry with God. I was angry with him for taking a lovely man who I didn't think deserved to die at 62. My husband was a big mischievous boy at heart. He was lovely. I met him when I was 14. Never wanted anybody else. Mm. Have never wanted anybody else. But because we met at a young age, I did have 44 years with him altogether. So there I was in a lovely home with everything that we'd wanted, that we'd achieved. My four children. The last one had decided to set up home with her partner. As my husband died in October, she moved out at Christmas. And there I was with my two dogs and me. And as I said, I didn't want to know about God at all. Don't talk to me about loving God. He's horrible. He takes away good people.
And is he at that point, then he removed your sister as well as your husband in a short time?
No, my sister had died previously.
Okay. I saw he was in a short space of time.
So. Well, I lost my mother and my sister in a very short space of time, literally within hours. Yeah. That was a shock. Uh-huh. So there's no good way of dealing with death. I can tell you that. If you get someone taken in a minute, it's like somebody taking an axe to you and taking half of you away. If you nurse someone through a horrible illness, best part of 4 years, in the end you are angry with them for not getting better. And then you wish they would die. And then when they die, you're guilty. It's horrible. There is no easy way of dealing with it. And if you don't deal with it with God, it's twice as hard. Anyhow, I went on and managed, and Jeff began to do Alpha courses. And because my second daughter wanted to know that her father was in heaven, she went to do the first Alpha course. And during it, she was filled with the Holy Spirit. And she came back and she told me all about it. She used to come and tell me every the day after. I think it was Tuesday evening. She used to come and see me and tell me about it. And I couldn't believe it when she came back from the Holy Spirit weekend, where you learn the teaching of the Holy Spirit. She was radiant, mm-hmm. absolutely shining. And she said, "Oh, it was amazing, Mum. Jeff prays for you, and you make your commitment. And she said, I'd seen other people go forward, and I'd seen some of them cry, and some of them fell over, and I thought, I'm not doing that. But she said, I went forward, and Jeff laid his hands on me, and I prayed the prayer, and I stood there, and I thought, I don't know, I can't stop my eyelids from fluttering. And she said, and the next minute I knew, I had fire running through me, through my arms and legs, and wasn't burning, it was ecstasy. And she said, oh, I didn't want that feeling to leave me. She said, it was amazing. And when I opened my eyes, I was flat on the floor. And I had no recollection of going down in the spirit whatsoever. So I said, this is a weird going on. So she said, well, anyway, Jeff wants to do another Alpha course. And because people will be coming in the evening from work, he wants somebody to provide them with a hot meal because it was autumn. So he wants you to do the cooking. I've always enjoyed cooking. That's one of the gifts that I have been given. There's another story about that, but another time. And so I said, so what does it entail? So I said, well, you've got to cook a simple meal, first course and a pudding. Someone else would do the teas and coffee. So I said, I won't have to go in to listen to this talk, will I? Mm-hmm. She said, no. I said, you can stay in the kitchen. I said, all right, tell Jeff I'll do it. So they had 90 people signed up for that Alpha course. So I cooked a two-course meal for 90 people for 10 weeks.
90?
Yeah. Yeah, this hall was filled with people. And I think we had something like minced beef and dumplings for the first week and probably some kind of tart for pudding. Anyway, I was out there in the kitchen. No, it was in the school. I beg your pardon, that one, and school hall. And I was in the kitchen tidying up, and they'd just done the teas and coffee, and a good friend of mine, a long, long-standing Christian, came and said, why don't you come and sit down, Beryl, and take the weight off your feet if you've been in the kitchen all the evening? No, I'm all right out here. Oh, come on, she's come. Come have your tea with us. Well, I didn't want to be rude to a good friend, so I went and I sat at the table. And the first talk, for those of you that haven't done an Alpha, is, or was, who is Jesus? I like people, I like history. And I sat and I listened, and I thought, well, it's not religious. There's nobody thumping the Bible at me. Yeah, it's quite interesting. So next morning, Meryl, anxious to know, she came and said, how did you get on last night? So I said, well, to be honest, I said, it wasn't what I expected. So she said, what did you mean? I said, well, it wasn't religious. I said, it was kind of interesting. And if I'm honest, I'm a bit confused. But still, I don't know if it's for me or not. I said, but I'm stuck with the cooking, so I'll be there for the next 9 weeks anyway. So next week came, same thing, did the food in the kitchen, clearing up. Hilary came and said, come on, come and sit down. I thought, well, I survived last week, so I'll go in and listen to it. At that time, Jeff was alternating with David, another friend of his who was a vicar from Cornwall, and David was taking that talk. And the second talk is the crucifixion. I sat, and it still moves me. It was the first time I had heard anybody describe exactly what happens when somebody is crucified. I had seen Jesus hanging on crosses in church and thought, how do you die from having nails through your wrists and your ankles? You know, it probably hurts a lot. How does it kill you? I didn't know about the beating, about the cat o' nine tails filled with flints that cut into the bone, lacerated the flesh on his back. I didn't know that he suffered because he couldn't lift himself above the nailed feet and his heart was bursting inside him. I didn't know that you slowly suffocated for hours and hours and hours. And I was broken. And I just wanted to know more about him. So that was it. I became a follower of Jesus. And I went on and helped out with all the Alpha courses. I went to church, began to enjoy church services. I did a Christian caring course. I did a prayer ministry course and was sort of officially in the prayer team for St. Peter's, during which I learned a lot about the right way to minister to people and the importance of prayer. So we got to a few years after, 1999, and as happens, when you give your life to God, the other side gets in. And you have the highs, and then you have the lows. And things were going on at St. Peter's, as it does in every congregation, little niggly things, unimportant, but, you know, nobody was coming forward for prayer. Nobody was interested in ministry. We were just going and doing the services. Sometimes it was good, sometimes it was a bit normal, ordinary, not particularly inspiring. And I'd booked to go to see my sister again in Australia in 1999. And I thought, when I was in Thomas Cook's booking in the March for Christmas, because lots of people go to Australia at Christmas, you have to book it in advance. And I thought, I'm jolly well going to not go to church anymore. I don't know why I'm doing all I've done for God. How arrogant can you be? All he'd done for me, and here I am a few years later saying, all I've done for you, God, and you're not doing anything for me. You're not sending anybody for me to pray over. How arrogant can you be? You're talking to the creator of the whole universe as if he's your next door neighbour who you don't reckon very much. Anyway, so while I was in there, I saw a brochure for a world cruise. I thought, that's just it. I've never been abroad much. I've only been to France once. My husband was not a travelling man. Done a good bit of the British Isles, but not abroad. So I took the brochure, spoke to the girl, and she said, if you book it within 48 hours, Thomas Cook are offering 10% off the price. It's 3 months. It's 26 different ports of call in 19 countries. I thought, I'm going to do it. So I went home and I said to John, I'm going to go on board, and I'm not even going to go to the captain's service on board. I'm going to go right back to being how I used to. I'm going to have a jolly good time. I'm going to spend a lot of money and enjoy it. So I went on board in that spirit of rebellion. And he put me in touch with Christians on every corner. I went to the restaurant, and it was full of lovely Indian waiters, lovely boys, and they all had names like Michael, Romeo, Raymond, Thomas, and they're all as brown as berries. And I moved back a few days here, and I got chatting to Raymond, our second waiter, our second steward at our table, and I said, Raymond, why is your name Raymond? Is it because your Indian name is too long to get on your name badge? And I was thinking like someone like Rajamani Bandaranaike, you know, a long one, you see. And he looked at me in astonishment. He said, no, madam, I'm a Christian. And so are all the boys in the restaurant. I thought, oh my God, you've put me in a restaurant full of Christians. Except for Sheriff. Sheriff looked at me and he said, I'm not a Christian, I'm a Muslim. I said, well, you would be, wouldn't you? Because he and I hit it off from the word go. He reminded me of my son. He was full of mischief in the nicest way. And he was a little monkey, actually. I call him the little monkey, and I shouldn't because he's very dark. Anyway, so time went on. I had been complaining that God didn't use me. I decided to go to Deck 12, to the self-service restaurant, one lunchtime, and there aren't many tables there with just two seats, but there was one, and the whole restaurant was full upstairs on Deck 12, except this table where one lady was sitting, and she was red-rimmed eyes, and she was sitting sort of snuffling into her tissue, and I sat opposite her, and I looked at her, and I said, would it help if you shared? And she burst into tears and she said, I shouldn't be on this voyage. I'm supposed to be with my husband, and he died in October. This was January. And she said, I feel so guilty because I don't think I should be doing this. But she said, my daughter encouraged me to come. So I told her of my situation and I said, can I pray for you? And she said, yes. So we prayed over the restaurant table. And I had the pleasure of seeing her for the rest of her time on board, going out and enjoying herself, because I said, that's what your husband would want you to do. And you will survive it. Look how many widows there are in the world. That was that. Went to the theatre. There was a man sitting next to me. He said, are you travelling on your own? I said, well, I'm sharing a cabin with three other ladies, but yes, I'm travelling alone. So he said, I'm with my mate. He said, I've never met him before. He's from New Zealand. He said, he's been widowed 4 years. He said, and I've been widowed 2 years, and I just can't get over losing my wife. He said, it's such a horrible time being on your own. So I said, would you like to share a drink with me after the show in the restaurant, the late night restaurant, we'd go and have a coffee or something. So they both came. And they both unloaded all their unhappiness and we got to pray together. And I hope that they went away in a bit more comforted, the fact that things would get better, which they do. And on it went, you know, everywhere. All the things I'd been saying, God did it. And I thought, I don't know, he's getting at me again. So anyway, the long and short of it, Sheriff was in trouble, and I won't go into that, it's a long story, but basically he was short of money. I could not believe that P&O paid their steward so little for 10-hour shifts 7 days a week. Believe you me, if you've got a job that doesn't pay you much, don't change it for a steward on a cruise line. In 2000, when the average wage was, the basic wage was about $3.50 an hour, P&O and all the cruise ships were paying their stewards 50p an hour. 50p an hour. A British ship. I couldn't believe it. And my boy was on board to try to save up for his sister's dowry, because dowries are a big thing in India. You can't marry your daughter without a dowry, at least not well. So his father had to have an operation. I said that I wasn't a rich lady, but I would raise money for his father's operation, because I said, how much is it? And Sheriff said, a lot of money, madam. He called me madam in those days, maybe £600 or £700. And that's how I came to learn that he probably wouldn't earn an extra £700 in the 6 months or so he was on board. So I thought, that's a 10% of what I'm paying on this cruise. I was paying between $6,000 and $7,000 for my cruise. I thought, that's a tithing. That's what we're supposed to do for God's work. So I told him I would come back, I would raise money for him, and we would send it to him when he went home to India. And he said, I don't understand why you do this, madam. I said, look, Sheriff, you're Muslim, I'm Christian. This is what love is. And I gave him the quotation, I think it's from Ephesians, I'm not sure, but anyway, it's the one you all know. Love is patient, love is kind, it does not envy, it does not boast, it always supports, it's always there. I said, that's what love is. It's not just an arm round you or a cuddle. I said, it's the whole thing. From that time on, he began to call me Mother Emma. And he's like a son to me. And anyway, in return, yes, we did raise the money. All my lovely friends in the village at St. Peter's, my family and people in Maidstone, we actually sent Bashir £1,500 very early on. And I said, and furthermore, Sheriff, I will pray for your father. I will pray that he will be restored. He had a smashed leg. And it's a very difficult operation in India, and you can't have treatment without paying for anything in India. Even the poor have to pay a few rupees. The government hospitals are awful. They don't see what treatment they can do. If Bashir had been taken to a government hospital, he would have had his leg amputated, full stop. That's it. That solves that problem. He went to a military hospital, and they rebuilt it, and he has steel in his leg with nuts and bolts. I've seen the x-ray. It is bolted together. It's a really, and he's also lost the use of his foot with damaged nerves. So anyway, we sent him £1,500, which, as it turned out, was enough for two operations. I came home from this cruise after 3 months, having seen poverty all round the world. I came back changed. I came back a different person, both spiritually and physically. Don't ever knock what you've got in this country, because you haven't any idea how the other half lives until you've seen it for yourself. I saw children begging in Mexico. I saw the divers in Acapulco who can only do 6 dives a year because they dive off a rock to earn money, and it's about, I don't know how many feet, it's a long, long way down, and they hit the water with force. Often they get brain damage and they can't work, so they're not allowed to do more than 6 dives a year.
Oh, right.
That's diving off the rocks at Acapulco.
How many metres do you know?
Oh, it's a long way. It's a huge cliff. It's like Beachy Head, and you dive down in a very narrow channel between...
And they dive head first or feet first?
Well, they dive head first.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Yes.
So it's a
heart-stopping thing. They stand on the edge of the cliff and they dive, and you just shut your eyes and think, if they misjudge it, there's a rock there. There's a rock there. There's a very narrow bit in the middle, but they do hit the water with force. We went on a safari from Durban to see the wild animals and Alps, and on the way from the town to the safari area, I saw the shanty towns, I saw the shacks, I saw the people living in filth. You could smell the rubbish from the coach. And the children standing, begging, outside the entrance to the safari secure area. There were children running alongside the coach, begging for pennies. I saw the back end of the Caribbean, away from the sandy beaches, the squalor, the rubbish, how they live in half-built houses. I'm amazed that they smile as much as they do. People smile in adversity, it seems. And so it went on, and I came back and I thought, I've got to do something. I don't know, I'm born. I'd taken a drawing course on board, and I told my pictures were good enough to sell. So I thought, I don't know, I've got to do something. We're doing this thing for Bashir, but apart from that, I've got to do something for these people that don't have anything. Well, I don't take a newspaper now, but then I did. And on that weekend, I came home on Wednesday, and on that weekend I got a colour magazine with the paper, and it was an article in there about Caroline Ahern, the comedian who, she died quite recently, but she'd just come back from India, where she'd been paying £11 a time for operations to remove cataracts from people's eyes. And I thought, oh, if I could sell a picture for sort of £10-15, I can find an organisation and I can send the money to them. That was on the Saturday. On Monday, I got 2 pieces of junk mail. Oh, and Sheriff had asked me to go to India for his wedding the next year. And I didn't want to go. I'll tell you in a minute, but I didn't want to go at that point. On the Monday, I got 2 pieces of junk mail. Usually I'd bin it, but one I opened, and it was from the Christian Mission for the Blind. Will you give £2 a month to help cure blindness in India and Africa? And I thought, this is twice in 3 days, God, you've put India and blindness in front of me. Is this what you really want me to do? If it is, give me a sign. Now, I don't know my Bible word for word, but during the next week, I'd sat up in bed after doing my prayers, and I was just sitting there receiving, and suddenly in my head, like someone typing on the screen, came, I think it's Mark chapter 10, verses 47 to 52. And I got out of bed and opened my Bible, and of all the chapters in the Bible, it was the story of Jesus healing blind Bartimaeus. So I thought, oh, still not believing. I went to church and I said to Dawn, another lady who's been a lifelong Christian, look, Dawn, since I've got back from India, this is what's happened. She said, how many more signs do you want, Beryl? I said, well, I really don't know. I said, I'm very unhappy about going to India. I know I know this young man for 3 months and I really love him a lot. He's a dear, dear boy. He's like a son to me. But I don't know his family. I don't speak any Indian languages. I'm a woman. I'm British. I'm old. And I'm white. It's not very good CV, is it? She said, I'll put you in touch with an organisation that deals with medical business in India. It's called International Needs, and they work with partners in their own countries because they understand the problems. So she said, there are Indian Christians who are in partnership with International Needs. So I got in touch with them. Long and short of it was I met Ken Yanakan and subsequently was invited to go and stay in their flat in Bangalore when I went next year. I'm sure I could get up there. That was that. But all through that year, I resisted going to India. I came back from the cruise and told my family that this young man had invited me to his wedding. And I said, but if his father's still ill, I don't want to sleep, put him out of his bed or whatever. You know, I don't know where I'm going to stay. Alison said, look, Mum, we've got this fortnightly holiday thing. She said, we're not using this year and we won't use next year. So that's a month. You can go for a month in our holiday accommodation. I said, but India's a big country, Alison. This chap lives in some place in Tamil Nadu. She said, let's just have a look in the brochure. She gets out this brochure of worldwide addresses. There's only 5 in the whole of India. And one of them is in Kunnur, where Sheriff lives. So I thought, oh, hang it, that's that then. So I phoned him up. I said, what do you know about the Taj Garden Retreat Hotel, Sheriff? He said, why do you want to know, Emma? I said, well, if your father's still ill when I come, I can stay. He laughed. He said, I did part of my training there. It overlooks my back garden. I thought, hang it, that's another thing. So then I thought, I'm going to Bangalore and I don't know any Hindi or Tamil or anything at all, whatever. I think they speak Konkani in Bangalore, another language. Anyway, I didn't know any of them. And during the summer, I think it was Angela and 2 other ladies had booked to go and listen to, what's the lady who was cured?
Jennifer
Rees-Larkham. She has an open day at her lovely bungalow, and the people were supposed to have booked. And I think one of my friends phoned me and said, "We've got a spare seat in the car. Do you want to come?" So I said, "Oh yeah, I'll come." So we drove out to, it's near Penshurst, and we got out the car and we walked down, and Jennifer opened the door, and there, sitting on the mat, is a guide dog for the blind. And I thought, God, you're doing it again, aren't you? Here we are, it's another blind. I said, whose is the dog? She said, oh, it's our speaker. It's Marilyn, the blind gospel singer. Oh, I said, I don't believe this. So she asked me, and I gave her the story at that point. She said, you must tell Marilyn, she'll be very interested. So come dinner time, I managed to get a word with Marilyn. And I said, the trouble is, Marilyn, I'm going to this place called Bangalore. It's a long way from the family who I only just got to know. I'll be on my own. I don't speak any languages. I might need to just speak to somebody who's English. And I'm really very bothered about it. She said, where are you going? I said, Bangalore. Oh, I've got a good friend who works in St. John's Hospital in Bangalore. She said, I'll give her your name. And she said, I'll give you her name and address. She's English. Oh, dear. And that's how it went on. Every time I put up a barrier, he knocked it away.
Yeah.
So I went, and I loved it. And I went to Bangalore, and I went round with the doctors, and we saw the conditions there of the poor. And I'd gone out there with the idea of coming back and fundraising to help them, and especially with blindness. But this was general. One day we'd been to a hospital, there were 228 7-year-olds in this school, and it was the annual check or the regular check that they do. Dr. Beulah Prasad took me with her, and I took notes. Out of all of those 228 children, only four had perfect health. All the others suffered from eye problems, ear problems, breathing problems, skin diseases, malnutrition. Every one of them was smartly dressed and clean, and knowing where they came from, it's a miracle that the parents managed to keep them so beautifully. They are a credit. Our children, by comparison, both in manners and in dress, are slovenly and unruly. Indian children are not. They're disciplined and they work hard because they know the value of learning. Otherwise, they're going to be at the bottom of the heap and they're never going to get anywhere. So we came back from this and they handed out vitamin A pills, which they give for eye. It helps with the eye. And a wormin capsule, because they suffer from worms, obviously. Another village I visited, they have rudimentary toilets, like a canvas with a bucket, which is taken and tipped into the jungle on the edge of the village. But there's no washing facilities, and the water is putrid. So they wash their cooking utensils in dirty water. So they get all sorts of things, and they get reinfected with worms. One village we went to, I wish I'd brought the photographs, but outside of the typical Indian hut, mud brick with whatever they get for the roof, there was a pool about so big. I don't know how deep it was. And I said to the doctor that I was with in the ambulance, I said, "Is that a drain hole?" He said, "No, that's their water supply." And it was green. It looked like a bowl of phlegm. It really did, viscous and ghastly. And he said, "That's all they have to wash in." But he said, "You go around the corner," which we did, and it was coming up to a Hindu festival, and there is a standpipe somewhere away, and they had got clean water from, or comparatively clean water from the standpipe, and they were washing the cow with it.
No.
Because the cow must be clean, because it's sacred. And that's the anomaly that you get, you know. On the way up to Bangalore, I passed the Kaveri River, the main river that supplies Tamil Nadu with a lot of its water. Oh, you never smell anything like it. It is awful. It's worse than the sewage works. And it's black. It's, if you imagine, what can I say, black ink with rubbish, dead animals in it, so much rubbish. And this stink, which is not only human waste, but industrial waste as well. And that's the main river. And that, and this is very typical all over India. In Sheriff's household, they have a water purifier. They purify the water, which comes from a spring from the top of the mountain and flows through their property. But even so, they filter it and they boil it before they use it. So I have never, on any occasion in that house, or any of his relatives' houses, suffered with stomach upsets because of the water, because that's what they do. But you see, even though it's a spring from the top of the mountain, you don't know if there's any dead animals in it. You don't know what's in it, so you have to take that precaution. Anyway, to come back to Beulah, we'd done this hospital round, and we were writing up the notes, and she said to me, "How did you come to be involved in this, Beryl? Because you're not a young woman." And I said, "Well, I suppose you could say it was when I went on board the ship in January 2000. And she leapt up from her seat and came round. Her seat was a little cubicle with a curtain, a desk and a chair. She leapt up and came round and she wept on my shoulder. And she said, "You're my answer to prayer." I said, "How do you make that out?" She said, "I've been qualified for 11 years. She said, 9 of those years I've had to work as a GP because there's been no funding for my speciality. She said, "I'm a qualified eye surgeon. And she said, in January 2000, I despaired of ever using my skills again, and I prayed to God to send me someone to help me set up a clinic for the blind, and here you are. Mm-hmm. And that was absolutely gobsmackingly amazing. Two women, two different cultures, never known each other before, but the significance of the date and me resisting, but in the end going, and I haven't regretted it. I've met with nothing but love, too much love. I've been spoiled dreadfully. Huge amount of respect, which I don't deserve. A huge amount of honour and spoiling, which I don't deserve. I can't tell you how lovely the people are. And I think that that's every human being is like that underneath, wherever you go. There is the rough side, but underneath there's this enormous well of love which is just waiting to be tapped into. And I think it's true to say that as God guides you, what you give, you get back fivefold. Certainly I do. And someone asked me when I came back, and I was telling them the story, what do you get out of this? I said, I've always been loved all my life by my parents, my sisters, by my husband, my children. But I'm more loved by everybody now than I've ever been in my life. And I know God loves me. So that's it. That's where I was. And that's where I shall continue to go as long as he gives me the strength. I'm hoping to go again, which will be my 14th or 15th visit in 17 years, in the new year sometime. Yeah. So if you've got any questions, if you want to know anything about the differences in Islam and Christianity, of which there's quite a few.
Yeah, she's got so much to say. I'm amazed you managed to do it in about half an hour there. And
all I can say to you
have
is
have a chat with her anytime.
If God wants you, he will get you. Listen to him when you pray. Listen to him. If you're not sure, ask him. Ask and you shall receive, Jesus said. And it is important that you spend time with God. It's very easy, and the younger you are, I don't know about that, I think the older of us as well, we slow down and there's just as much to do. But it's so easy to let life take over and not spend time with him. And you need it. Because after all said and done, as Jeff said to me about, you know, the afterlife, he said, no matter how disbelieving you are and however much you rely on yourself, there comes the final moments when there's nobody but you and him. And that's absolutely true. There will be that final moment when everybody else has slipped away or to one side and there's just you and God or Jesus, whatever. Yeah. Thank you for listening.
Yes.
And God bless you.
Thanks.
I was going to... Thank you.